Belmore Brown was a hunter, artist, writer, and explorer, and almost the first to climb Mount McKinley 100 years ago this month. They're planning a centennial commemoration next month in Talkeetna. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. It's another face of Alaska history this week. Our number is 1-800-478-8255. That's 478-TALK and Anchorage local call at 550-8422. Email talk at alaskapublic.org. We're about to go exploring in the Belmore Brown Archives on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Someone you know is likely a trust beneficiary, a family member, friend, coworker, neighbor, maybe you. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority supports a statewide system of care for people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism and substance abuse, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injury. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, here for all Alaskans, mhtrust.org. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Boy, oh boy, I'm telling you, what a story that hardly anybody knows. The 1912 climb of Mount McKinley. It kind of gets lost in the midst of all the other history that was taking place at the same time. Katmai blew up, Nova Rupta erupted. There was a big earthquake not long after Belmore Brown and two others attempted the summit of Mount McKinley. If they hadn't gotten down when they did, they would have been annihilated in all the slides and everything that happened in that earthquake. All this 100 years ago in June of 1912. Go back a few years before that, a guy by the name of Frederick Cook is trying to climb the mountain and claims that he did, and Belmore Brown's the guy that proved that he didn't. And he was along for part of that expedition, and it goes on. Then you go to the next year, and you get Hudson Stuck, Walt Harper, Harry Karstens, who did finally attain the summit. Or you go back 2 years, and you're at the Sourdough Expedition, where Tom Lloyd, Peter Anderson, Charlie McGonigal, and Billy Taylor just made it to the wrong summit of Mount McKinley, or it would have been them, the Sourdoughs. It's a fascinating piece of Alaska history, and it happens at a time when access to this country was so difficult. It's very, very difficult for us to imagine, let alone for somebody in the lower 48 who's not acquainted with where the roads are and are not in Alaska. So this is going to be kind of fun. The Northern Susitna Institute is doing a centennial commemoration next month, and the director of that institute is Joe Page, also of the Denali Arts Council, I understand, right? Right, Joe?
Oh, yes. I've got a history with lots of organizations here in Talkeetna.
And basically this is going to be a whole day. I think it's a Saturday, right?
That's correct. We're going to start out with, we're going to feature Belmore's artwork in the morning, because I think we'll discover over the course of this morning that he went on to become quite a powerful artist. So we're going to celebrate his artwork along with his son George's. And then we're going to have a full day of plein air painting here around the community. We're going to take a look at the exhibit, the newly remodeled exhibit at the Talkeetna Historical Society. And then we're going to top it all off with a presentation by Brian Ochanek, which is going to feature some of the old historic photos from the 1906 and 10 and 12 expedition, along with some of his more contemporary photos. And I think that's going to be the culmination of our celebration.
And oddly, also connected by telephone from Talkeetna, we have Brian Ochanek. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Brian.
Thanks, Steve. Good morning.
Good morning. It's really great to have you with us. Brian, for those who do not know, is I will say, a legendary mountaineering guide and extremely modest person, and did run Alaska Denali Guiding, but he's retired from that now, and he has been spending some time at the Belmore Brown Archives, which are mostly located at Dartmouth University at Hanover, New Hampshire. And Brian, this must have been a lot of fun.
It was incredible, Steve. It was like opening up a treasure chest. Boxes and boxes of photographs and negatives and color glass slides of Belmore Brown's trips here to the Denali region and also to other areas in Alaska, in his journals and some of his sketches and paintings.
So now Belmore, among the many things that he did, and I have a book that was loaned to me a little bit, a biography of Brown, which includes reproductions of a whole lot of his paintings, some of which I recognize from when I was a kid. And it's not that I was, you know, I'm so old that I was a fan of Belmore's stuff for the most part, I don't think. It was a little preceded me, but there were others that were very influenced by him, and he kind of really was one of the formative characters of a style of American sportsman's expression, let's call it. It's almost a folk art. But the last part of this book is all articles he wrote for outdoors magazines. And I totally recognize it. I totally recognize just the feeling and the mood and the taste that it gave me as a young person to for the outdoors, because I was surrounded by it. I grew up in the outdoors. But, this taste, of this zest for it that is expressed so beautifully in these paintings and also in these articles, which are all about, hunting and fishing and going to wild country. And I guess he also did speaking tours. And what you have is the photographs that he would use for the speaking tours?
Yeah, part of the collection was a collection of colored glass slides that were produced from black and white negatives and then hand-painted.
So, yeah, because this is before we even had a color film of any kind, Kodachrome.
That's
or
correct.
Anything. Yeah.
Yep, and they depict his expeditions up here in 1906, 1910, and 1912 to the Denali region, and he used those pictures on his lecture tours.
Now, it's so hard for me to get my head around the difficulties of this expedition of 1912, Brian, and it must have taken you a while to penetrate it as well. You can sort of imagine it, but it is such a colossal achievement that you kind of almost have to imagine it in pieces. And it starts all the way down in Seward.
That's right. It starts even a year before. They had to get dogs to go to the mountain. They wanted to approach the mountain in the winter so they could be there ready to climb the mountain during the late spring and summer season. And dogs were a premium at the time. So in the spring of 1911, they bought dogs because that's when the dogs were cheapest. People didn't want to summer over the dogs. So they bought the dogs and started preparing for the trip then. And two members of the expedition landed in Seward in December of 1911. Merle Lavoie and Arthur Atten. Atten lived in Valdez. Merle was from Seattle. And they started dog sledding equipment for the expedition towards Denali. In 1912, the railroad had been under construction, headed towards Fairbanks, but had only gotten as far as Portage. And there was no winter construction going on, so the railroad bed was used for a dog sled trail. And there was a lot of traffic going to Iditarod, and the trail had recently been staked and marked from Iditarod to Nome. So there was commerce back and forth from Iditarod and Nome to Seward. So they had a good trail, but they also had a very unusually warm winter that year. It was the first winter that anybody remembered Kenai Lake not freezing over, and there was rain and thaws, and the trail as far as Portage was just miserable going. And then in late January, Herschel Parker and Belmore Brown arrived by steamer to Seward and hunted down somebody that they could join to work their way towards Susitna Station along the Iditarod Trail, where they would meet up with the other two. And they ended up making a deal with one of the mail carriers, a man by the name of Voss, and he carried their 300 pounds of gear, and they manhandled his second sled, which carried the second-class mail. And neither Parker nor Brown were used to manhandling a dog sled, and it just trashed them, wore them out. Those first few days on the trail were incredibly hard.
Well, it was, but there was plenty more to come.
That's right. There was. And when they got to Portage, the Parker or Brown ran into a fellow that he knew who had a boat, and they decided that they would boat from there to Kinnick. Kinnick was the center of commerce for access into the Susitna Valley at the time. And they loaded all their gear into a boat and went up Turnagain Arm. And when they got to Fire Island, they ran into lots of pack ice and then ended up getting into a big wind and snowstorm and big white caps and had to row all night long to keep from getting swept out with the tide. And they ended up trying once again to go around Fire Island and into Kinnick Arm, and once again ran into the same poor conditions and ended up having to boat all the way back to Glacier Creek, which is where Girdwood is. And fortunately, they ran into another dog sled driver they had met in Seward. His name was, they called him Dog Griffith. He was well known on the Iditarod Trail. He had just made a trip all the way from Nome to Seward with a load of gold and was headed back. And they were able to catch a ride with him and go up over Crow Pass and down Eagle River and roadhouse to roadhouse. There were roadhouses every 10 to 20 miles along the route, depending on the topography, and across the Moose Meadows there at along the Kinnick River and to Old Kinnick, where they stayed at a roadhouse that Belmer had actually helped construct on a trip in 1906 when he was up the Manuskin Kinnick Rivers collecting specimens, large mammal specimens, for universities and museums back east. And then at Kinnick, they caught up with Lavoie and Atten, who had incredibly already gotten their expedition supplies all the way up past Talkeetna, up the Chilitna River to just above the confluence with the Tokositna River. Of course, there was no trail up the Susitna River at all. Once they got to Susitna Station and left the Iditarod Trail, they were on their own, breaking trail, and they would snowshoe ahead with the dogs, and dogs would follow, pulling heavy sleds, and they would relay their gear, piece by piece.
Wow! Yeah, yeah. I'm gonna stop the story, but I want to get back to it, Brian. You've got it all laid out for us. This is fantastic. But I want to turn to our third guest, who is Arthur Mannix, co-owner of Top Notch Log Builders, and also joins us by telephone from Talkeetna. Arthur, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Pleasure to be here, and also, you know, in particular with Brian, who knows as much about the history of the Alaska Range as he does about, you know, having traveled on foot in all the nooks and so many nooks and crannies of the Alaska Range over the past 35 or 40 years, that he knows he's traveled more anywhere in the Alaska Range than anyone, and it's just wonderful to have him as a resource. But like one of the things that that Belmore really epitomized was a life in the open. He was truly a rustic Renaissance man, and he and his party really did epitomize that self-reliance that was so necessary to pull off the kinds of things that they did.
It's really funny. I don't know, when you read like Bob Marshall, you get the same feeling. These people are almost superhuman in their zest for the outdoors, and John Muir, the same deal. You know, they just, oh well, I just bunk down for the night then with a little fly over me. I was just like, and you wonder.
Oh, yeah. And then,
these
and
people
then
are
combine.
Made out of something pretty strong and pretty powerful. But Arthur, I want to connect you personally to this story and the saga of Belmore Brown. And I think to do that, all we have to do is point out that in your younger days, you were living in some land that belonged to the family.
Yeah, actually, it was just a by strange coincidence. What's really weird is when I was a child, just growing up north in New York City, one of the most meaningful parts of my life would be going down to the American Museum of Natural History, and I just gravitated towards the wildlife exhibits there, not knowing that Belmore had done all the oil paintings.
All those dioramas behind all those animals.
Yeah, and yeah. So I already had that kind of in my head. And anyway, years later, I was pedaling my bicycle. I was going to school at the University of New Hampshire, and having taken a bit of time off from school, and my brother and I went out west and went climbing out west, and I wanted to go back to school, but I wanted to save money for rent, and I sewed up a 16-foot diameter dome tent and was planning on living in that for the last 2 years of college, rent free essentially. But so I was pedaling my bike, looking for and asking, knocking on doors and saying if anybody could use a handyman or I'd be willing to pay rent in order for a place to pitch my tent. And lo and behold, I get out to the end of this beautiful peninsula, this estuary, Oyster Bay and Great Bay on coastal New Hampshire. And I go down and there's stone walls and these oak and hickory forests. And this little white-haired lady answers the door, and I gave her my spiel that I wanted to go to school and live in a tent. And could they use a handyman or could I pay rent? She said, let's go for a little bit of a walk. So we were walking and talking a little bit. And my brother and I had hitchhiked back from climbing in the bugaboos with my brother, and I had a little pin that said Canadian Mountain Holidays. She said, oh, Canadian Mountain Holidays, that's interesting. Hans Mosher is a friend of the family. And I was stunned. Hans Mosher was an early climber in Canada and with many first ascents, including the Wickersham Wall in Denali in 63.
Oh, my God.
And he also started helicopter skiing and such. And anyway, I was struck because Hans Mosher was a friend of this woman, Evelyn. And we walked a little bit, and she said, well, what do you want to do with your life? And I just said, gosh, you know, I'd like to try to get my degree. And then I'd really like to hitchhike up to Alaska and try to climb Mount McKinley. And she stopped right there, and she said, that's very interesting. My father led expeditions up McKinley in 1910 and 1912, and you can set up your tent right over there. And so I lived for a couple of years on the Brown property, 140 acres of Crumbs Creek came up and smelt ran up it. There were beaver ponds and deer, and it was about a 10-mile bike ride or ski to school. And but she let me study in her office, and in her office it was festooned with Belmore's oil paintings. There was a rock on the desk with a rock from Brown Tower that Belmore had gotten in his 1912 expedition. There was a Russian samovar that was given to Belmore by Chief Shakes, the Tlingit chief. That was another adventure down in southeastern Alaska in 1902 and 1903. And the cover of that book that Taslina dropped down for you has a picture of the chief's an oil painting called The Chief's Canoe, and that was hanging in the office there when he went down the Stikine River with Chief Shakes and the Tlingits just after he was.
I love that painting.
Yes, and that was in her office. So anyway, I ended up graduating from school, and Bradford Washburn was a good friend of the family. He'd come up to visit the Browns, and then Robert Bates, who wrote that book about Belmore. And he was the chairman of the American Alpine Club and led expeditions up K2.
So, in other words, Arthur, you had some aspirations, and you and your brother are doing some climbing and exploring, and you're doing pretty well. And all of a sudden, you hit this bullseye.
Yeah, and it was just amazing. And actually,
you
when
hit
I
the mother. You hit the mother load, kid.
I know. I was stupefied with the experience. And so, anyway, I graduated from school, and I didn't even go to graduation. I packed up my stuff, and I just gave Eb a big hug right up there. Their property was called Salty, and they've since donated it. It's a conservation reserve now. But anyway, I gave her a big hug, and I just stuck out my thumb and hitchhiked to Alaska right there to meet my brother to go climbing. And I just remember leaving Salty, and she said, you go to Alaska, Arthur, you know, you do it. She had grown up, and her dad had dragged her around British Columbia as a kid, living in a teepee, and she had just an amazing life experience. And she was a real innovator, too. She was the first. She developed the outdoor education at the University of New Hampshire, the department there. And she, early on, had curriculum for professional outdoor guides and such. She was anyway, it was a fantastic way to, and when I got to Talkeetna, I was beside myself. I felt like I'd lived here for years, even though I'd never even been to the place.
Did you ever climb the mountain?
I was very fortunate to climb the mountain, and I was also very fortunate to work as a guide for Brian, who was the most experienced fellow up there. And so but, you know, with respect to this, the whole thing with self-reliance, is that Belmore Brown and those guys, you know, from being such an oil painter, and they had a mountaineering history, was on the first descent of Mount Olympus in the Olympic Peninsula. And then also, like, they were hunters and such, and when they shot sheep, they skinned out the sheep, and they liked the oily, fatty skins were the best on the glacier, and they used the very skins of the animals they shot to advance up the glacier for sleeping robes, and then they made a smokehouse and smoked the meat from the game they were shooting. It was nuts. And but then also he followed it up by being a political activist, and he, along with Charles Sheldon, were some of the main influential people in the creation of Denali National Park.
Absolutely. Well, thanks a lot for that, Arthur. That what a testimonial. So great to have you on the show. You're so enthusiastic, and you got so much to say. But
so
does Brian, and so does Joe. It's just like
We're all long-winded.
Well, I want to put out the phone number so our long-winded listeners can get a chance too. 1-800-478-8255 statewide. 1-800-478-8255. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, and email is talk@alaskapublic.org. And I don't have any email so far. All I have is the email from Ira, Alaska. It says there's no more free beer. Did you know that? Yeah, you're going to charge $1 for that free beer now. So
that's a Talkeetna brewery.
Well, all right, that's wonderful. So the continuing expanding cultural resources of Talkeetna and the Northern Susitna Valley in general include the Northern Susitna Institute, which next month is going to have the centennial commemoration of Belmore Brown and his amazing climb in 1912. And Brian Ochnick clearly knows all about this climb and also all about the mountain. So, Brian, I want to ask you to kind of pick up the story maybe at the Muldrow Glacier so that we can start getting up that hill.
Well, once they crossed the range, which was, a pretty big deal in itself, they spent, several weeks just getting from the Chulitna side of the Alaska Range over to the Muldrow side of the range through uncharted territory, and were just ecstatic to finally get to the north side and like Arthur said, to find sheep. They were hungry and needed meat for them and the dogs. And it was a paradise, just incredible. The wind-blowing conditions, the lack of snow was great for the animals. And they made their way to Cache Creek, the same place where the sourdough exhibition in 1910 had approached the range.
And if we were to have a
whole lot of information from the sourdough expedition. They knew they had been there, but they didn't have any email connection or anything, and so
yeah.
Information was lacking. They had to basically rediscover the route. They had to re-find Cache Creek, the key to access to the Muldrow Glacier up through McGonigal Pass, which is just a little pass through the foothills of the range, but get you further up the Muldrow Glacier. And they found that after days of tromping around in the hills, and in April and early May, they relayed all their gear by dog team up the Muldrow. And the Muldrow is a pretty steep glacier with several big ice falls, lots and lots of big crevasses. As Washburn was so fond of saying, you could drop a whole train into some of the crevasses. They're just monsters. But they made their way. They didn't lose anybody. And they cached gear at the base of Carson's Ridge at 11,000 feet at the very head of the Muldrow. And at first they were thinking, man, we'll just leave the dogs here. We'll make a quick trip of it. We'll run up, take the top, and come down. But they were starting to get an understanding of the scale of the mountain. It was really big, And they quickly shelved that idea, left their stuff well marked with long pole, and they had an empty sled that they were able to stand on end as a marker. And they went down to Cache Creek, and they spent a wonderful month of R&R there. Belmore's journals are just incredible. I mean, they were just enjoying it so much. They were watching the snow melt and the flowers come into bloom, hunting, exploring the foothills, rambling all over along the base of the range, just marveling at the beauty of the place.
Now, can you give me some, Brian, can you give me some geography as, like, if I were to go to Cache Creek right now, where they were, would that be in the park, or where is that situated?
That's right. It certainly would be. You would go in there the way they left. You would go to Wonder Lake and walk down the trail to the McKinley River gravel bars, and then walk over an old lateral moraine of the Mulder Glacier called Turtle Hill, and cross the Clearwater River and go up a beautiful crystal clear stream coming out of the foothills called Cache Creek. And they had their base camp at the uppermost willows along Cache Creek.
Okay, I've got it now.
Yep.
It's such beautiful terrain. It's amazingly beautiful terrain.
Yeah, and it's like not too far away is one of the cabins that was used by the Wolf guy.
Oh, yeah, you're thinking of Adolph Murray.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep. Yep, that's to the east of ways.
Yep.
That's right.
Okay, so we're going to have to take a break here, and I want to try and pace this and certainly get this whole climb in, and Brian, you've got all the resources. And I could tell this is going to be quite the presentation that you're going to be asked to do next month.
Well, it's really fun because Belmore's expedition, he and Parker and Lavoie all took pictures, and they left a wonderful record of their trip, and you can trace it step by step. You can just recognize the features and tell where they're at, and it's wonderful to follow along and to see the country as it was 100 years ago.
Yeah, and it really is 100 years ago. And it spans what? They started down there in Seward. What time is still in the winter, right? February?
Yeah, so Parker and Brown left Seward on the 1st of February.
Uh-huh.
They arrived at Upper Cache Creek, where they put their base camp at, about the 25th of April.
Mm-hmm.
And today, 100 years ago today, they were just starting up Carson's Ridge. They had gone back up the Muldrow Glacier after their month in the tundra, and gotten to the very head of the glacier, and put a camp in at what's called Carson's Notch, and for the first time they were on a ridge, a really spectacular, elegant snow and ice ridge. You know, they weren't in the confines of a glacier valley. With everything above them, all of a sudden they were on this ridge crest with big exposure on both sides and on the mountain.
And a whole lot of mountain ahead of them, though. I mean, and then there's a big old ice fall, right?
That's right. There's a huge ice fall. Between the two summits.
And this is what, like 3,000 feet or so of ice fall?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's huge. It's the Harper Glacier, and it comes down and then just drops off a huge granite cliff onto the upper Muldrow Glacier. And the sourdoughs had discovered the key to getting up onto the Harper Glacier, and that was by what was called at the time the Central Northeast Ridge. Today it's named Carson's Ridge after Harry Carson's, who was with Hudson Stuck in 1913. And they followed the same ridge that the sourdoughs did. And they were thinking that they could go from their camp at Carson's Notch all the way up to what they called the Grand Basin, which is the Harper Glacier, in a day. And they were quickly reminded by the mountain that indeed it was bigger than they thought it was. And so they got about halfway up Carson's Ridge and left a cache and went back down. And you got to remember, this is, 100 years ago, climbing techniques and climbing equipment was quite a bit different than it is today. They were wearing basically L.L. Bean boots, shoe packs, leather tops, rubber bottoms, and they were using alpenstocks, very long ice axes, and carrying a garden spade shovel. And they would chop steps where it was hard and icy, big bucket steps, and where it was softer snow, they would use the garden shovel and dig a staircase.
Holy mackerel, no crampons.
They had what they called ice creepers, and I've seen them. They're very short little points. They're very small.
So you couldn't kick it in and stand on it.
No, they did serve them well up high on their summit attempt on hard wind-blowing conditions where it wasn't too steep. They could walk nicely with them. But on the ridge itself, anything steep and exposed, they depended on big steps that they cut themselves.
Did they carry ladders? There's constant reference to crevasses. They had a lot of trouble with crevasses. Did they know to carry like something big and long?
well, they didn't. They did a lot of route finding, and they found a few crevasses by falling through the bridges, and getting themselves back out. Of course, they didn't have any seat harnesses, any standard harness system that we use today. They're just
they didn't have any protection. They have a protection of any sort, basically.
No, they were really trail hardened people. I'll tell you what, life was not easy.
Brian, it's so much fun to talk to you. I got to take a little break and then come back with you. We're talking with Brian Ochanek, former owner of Alaska Denali Guiding, and we're talking about Belmore Brown's amazing 1912 climb almost all the way to the top of Mount McKinley as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station.
The Alaska Department of Health and Social Services has over 70 job openings available statewide in nursing, social work, and child protection. There's nothing more important than protecting the health and well-being of Alaska families, so take the first step towards a meaningful career. Visit dhss.alaska.gov and click on careers. Join their team and make a difference every day. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. Avtech is recruiting rural Alaskans for computer and network training with no cost tuition for qualified applicants. For more about the Village Internet Agent Program, call 1-800-478-5389. This message sponsored by Avtech, Alaska's Institute of Technology.
Well, the Northern Susitna Institute on the 21st of July is going to have the centennial commemoration of Belmore Brown's climb and Belmore Brown and Belmore's son, as far as that's concerned. And I'm so excited because part of what they're going to do is have artists. Belmore Brown was an artist, and they're going to have not just any kind of artist, but what they call plein air artists. These are people that actually make their art outdoors. They make the art in the place that they're making the art about. And there's something about that breathes a different sort of life into the art that's made. And then they get to show it on that day. So it's going to be quite the day in Talkeetna. I believe it's a Saturday. And we have with us the director of the Institute, Joe Page, Arthur Mannix, who is a frequent volunteer and instructor at the Institute, and Brian Ochanek, mountaineering guide, and the person who's been researching in the Belmore Brown archives. And it's been absolutely fascinating. Brian has taken us all the way up to the Harper, what is it, the Harper Icefall?
The Harper Glacier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so now we have essentially, we've left one person behind in the expedition, right, with the dogs and all?
That's right. Arthur Atten stayed at Cache Creek and stayed with the dogs, and also took barometer readings every day so that they could standardize their barometer readings, as the weather systems changed and stuff while they were on the mountain, so they could calculate the exact altitude that they were at.
Okay. And so now we're down to Belmore Brown along with Merle Lavoie and Herschel Parker.
That's right.
And Parker, he's referred to as Dr. Parker, right?
That's right. He was a physics professor from the University of Columbia.
Uh-huh. And they're essentially thinking it's easier to get to the summit than it is.
Well, yeah. The mountain, just proved to be on a really grand scale. And they were familiar with the mountain. They had tried, of course, to climb it from the south in 1910 and explored routes in 1906. And And so they knew it was a big place, but as Brown said, going up Carson's Ridge, he was had his eye on some rocks, and he chopped steps for a half an hour, and the rocks were further away than when he started. So it was time consuming, but they were moving steady and they were doing well. They did camp in a really wild place on Carson's Ridge. They got themselves up to about 13,200 feet, which is a knife edge. It's really, really an airy place. And they just ran out of energy, and Brown had been breaking trail all day. And he kept suffering from bouts of snow blindness, and he got snow blindness again. And they had to call it a day, but none of them were about to go back down and lose any ground, so they just dug in right there on this really remarkable place. I've been there many times, and it would be a wild, wild place to camp. But they pulled it off, and they got themselves up into the rocks at the top of Carson's Ridge, right at the base of a beautiful granite tower that now is called Brown Tower. And at this point, both Parker and Lavoie started having a lot of problems digesting the pemmican that was the staple of their diet. It was pemmican that same type of pemmican that they had used in 1910, had served them very well, and it had been canned in the U.S., and they'd brought it up by steamer and carried it by dog sled for 400 miles to the base of Denali, and now had packed it all the way up Carson's Ridge, and they couldn't eat it.
Brian, you as a mountaineer, you knew what the problem was.
Yeah, and they suspected what the problem was, too, that it was just too high a fat content in it, and just high-fat foods just don't burn very well in a low-oxygen environment in the body. And Brown had been doing okay on it, and then when they moved up to their next camp, suddenly he couldn't eat it either. And it left him incredibly short of food and calories. They basically were subsisting off of hardtack, raisins, tea, and sugar. And all of them started suffering dearly from the cold. It was cold anyway. The Harper Glacier is up high. By now, they're camped at 16,000 feet. It can get brutally cold when the sun goes down or if there's any wind at all. But they were not only suffering during the day, they were all sleeping very, very cold. And so they were getting very little rest. They were wearing everything they had, layers and layers of wool, canvas wind gear, their outer parkas. They changed from their shoe packs to mukluks. But all of them were really, really suffering from the cold. But finally, they got up to where they put their high camp in at 16,600 feet in between two small ice falls in the Harper Glacier. And they had their eye on the upper northeast ridge of the South Peak.
Wasn't right that the highest camp at that point?
It, you know.
Okay, go ahead. Who was that, Arthur?
Oh yeah, wasn't that the highest camp ever established in North
That's
America
right.
at that point?
At that point, they were higher than anybody had camped, and the highest thing they'd gone in North America was the summit of St. Elias, a little over 18,000 feet at the time. But nobody had camped at 16.6 yet. And the sourdoughs had their high camp was way down on the Muldrow Glacier, and they did this horrendous one-day ascent of the North Peak. And that's really interesting, Steve, because the sourdoughs had said they'd left their flagpole, their 14-foot flagpole, guide out on the North Peak somewhere. And Belmore Brown had a powerful pair of binoculars, and he just kept looking and looking and looking for that flagpole. And I found in the archives a wonderful photograph taken of the top of Pioneer Ridge, which is the way the sourdoughs would have gone, the last highest part of Pioneer Ridge to the summit of the North Peak. And Belmore took a picture of that ridge from the northeast ridge of the South Peak, and it was a very clear day, and the picture is really sharp. And, you know, you can put it on the computer and blow it up and look at it. And I studied and studied that picture to see if I could see anything that would resemble a pole and couldn't. And Belmore Brown said that he studied every nook and cranny, every piece of that Northeast Ridge, and could not find a flagpole.
And he had a hunter's eye.
Yeah, and he did a lot of scoping around with binoculars. He loved looking at the country with binoculars. That's
well,
right.
Well, you've been on that, right?
Yes.
And did you find any sign of it?
No. I haven't been on the upper part of Pioneer Ridge. I've been up to the north summit and have looked down that ridge, but nobody has seen that pole. You know, it probably blew down many, many years ago, but we've always talked about, you know, if it was guide down, those ropes are still down in the snow someplace. The pole could blow down, the ropes could sever, but somewhere under the snow, those ropes would be tied around something.
Wow.
Hey, but, Brian, you've come across other evidence of earlier expeditions in up in the area, haven't you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that's what is really gets a person excited about these early trips is stumbling upon evidence of them, you know, an old cairn, a ring of rocks that held down a tent someplace, some piece of a wooden box. Yeah, it's an environment that preserves things very, very well.
Yeah. Karen and I have had a trip in the past, and we are going to go back to Muckluck Pass to look for Muckluck's grave. So that's been a kind of a task of ours, and you know.
Yeah.
One of their dogs, or their favorite dogs, Muckluck, was killed in a fight over some sheep meat by the other wolf pack, the other dog team. Arthur Atten was really bummed because it was his favorite dog, and so they erected a mausoleum for Muckluck out of boulders at the base of what is now Anderson Pass, and they named it Muckluck Pass.
And you're looking for that.
Yeah, what the heck, you know?
Yeah. that's man, I'm telling you, only in Talkeetna. before we actually attack the summit here, Brian, let's go for a few calls. Stu in Anchorage, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yeah, thanks. I have a question for Brian. Folks in the MCA were trying to figure out who had the first recorded ascent of Mount Susitna. Of course, the Dena'ina and the Kenazi were all over it for hundreds of years. But I think it boiled down to Belmore Brown. Is that what you do? You have him on top of Mount Susitna trying to scout a route?
Well, they did try to go up Susitna. They actually didn't get to the top because it got really foggy and rainy. This was I think it was their 1906 expedition.
Yes,
they took a boat up to Susitna and parked and beat their way up through the brush. And there was a surveyor on the expedition that Brown was accompanying, and they were going to do triangulations and stuff from the summit. And then didn't actually make the summit, did what they could from brush line below the cloud level, and then came back down. But then later, some of the same expedition went up Mount Yenlo, not the highest point in the Yenlo Hills, but one of the southern summits.
Hmm. Yeah,
okay,
thanks
a lot. I was wondering, so he didn't get the first recorded ascent then?
No, not right. From what I've read, they did not get all the way to the top.
But they did. He went all the way around the Alaska Range, right?
Well, Cook did in 1903.
Ah, I see.
But not in 1906. They came by pack train from Tyonek, is where they got dumped off. They swam the horses ashore, and then they crossed over the Beluga Hills to the Taal Shalitna. And interesting, in the Beluga Hills, there were coal seams that were burning, and they lost some horses in one. They actually fell through the duff into a coal seam and got so badly burned they had to put them down.
Yeah.
And then they tried to get over the range through Mystic Pass in Shalabarger. Brown and Burrill, Edward Burrill, went up into Shalabarger Pass there by the Kachatna Spires, but it was unfeasible for a pack train of horses. People could walk through but not take horses, you know. And then they went on all the way over to the Tokositna Glacier and explored around the Ruth area.
Yeah.
Before okay, before going back to the Cook Inlet.
Let's jump another call here. Cheryl in Anchorage, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi, my question is, did Belmore Brown visit Alaska after 1912?
That's a very good question. Not that I'm aware of. He went back to the States and then soon thereafter moved to Canada and got married about 1914.
And it was around the Banff area, right, where he ended up living, yeah.
And his daughter, Evelyn, came to Alaska a number of times and did trips up in the interior, then out on Montague Island, and so she came up. Yeah. And his son, George, Joe Page has some interesting research that he's done some sleuthing on the Brown, and he has some interesting stories about Belmore's son.
Well, George was on the 1948 expedition with Brad Washburn, and in fact, he was the expedition's artist, and I believe there was an exhibit at the Anchorage Museum here this past April that was quite lovely of George's paintings from that expedition. And I think one of the things, we'll get back to Brian's story, but ultimately, George was a family. George could lord it over his father because, in fact, George was able to stand on the summit, whereas Belmore did not.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it is about time to get back to the summit. Cheryl, thanks for that question.
Thanks.
All right. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Home, it's where you lay your head, eat home-cooked meals, and gather with friends. Home is where you grew up and learned about life. Alaska is home, and when you choose to violate someone by committing sexual assault, you harm them, and you harm yourself, your friends, your family, your home, and Alaska. No one deserves to be sexually assaulted, so make the right choice. Real Alaskans choose respect. This message brought to you by the Alaska Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Well, we're talking about Belmore Brown and the centennial of Belmore Brown's 1912 attempt at the summit of Mount McKinley. Almost made it. This email from Mary of Ward Cove says, wow, in the same room as Belmore Brown's painting of Chief Shake's canoe? Sounds like his life was set out before him like a magic carpet. P.S. And I love the dioramas at the Museum of Natural History. So Mary hopes, Art, that you appreciated that painting you were living next to.
My goodness. And as you know from that book that you've got, the abundance of other paintings that Belmore's painted in his day.
All right, Brian, we're starting to run out of time, and I'm worried we're not going to run out of expedition. We need to get to as far as the expedition got.
Yeah, well, like you said, they got so close. It was actually June 29th. They got up in the morning. It was just a crystal clear, absolutely beautiful day. They got a start from their high camp at about 6 in the morning, intending to climb at a rate of about 500 vertical feet an hour is what they were hoping to do. And they ascended off the Harper Glacier and up on the Northeast Ridge. And at that point on the Northeast Ridge, there's these beautiful granite boulders scattered along the ridge, and they just were able to weave in and out of the boulders. And for the first time on this expedition, 1912, they were up high enough and looking down where they had explored in 1910. They could see the Ruth Amphitheater, the Great Gorge of the Ruth Glacier, Explorer's Peak, which they had climbed, Mount Huntington, which they had named, Mount Danbeard, which they had named, and Moose's Tooth, which they had named Mount Hubbard at the time. So it was country they knew very, very well, and they were able to just watch and look at the terrain below them as they ascended the Northeast Ridge towards the summit. And things were going well. They were climbing a little bit slower than they had hoped, but still making good time. And as they got up to about 19,000 feet at the final head wall of the summit, the weather started to change. There were low clouds on the south side of the range. It had built up more and more during the day, and they were starting to rise, and soon there were wisp of clouds coming over the ridges where they were, and soon it started to blow like crazy, and it began to pick up more and more. But they knew they were so close, and they just kept chopping steps up this last summit headwall, zigzagging up, very cognizant of the fact that off to the left was a big ice fall that they could get disoriented in poor light conditions, poor weather. They knew they didn't want to venture over to the left at all, especially coming down, and working their way up, and soon battling just a full-on gale. They're having a very difficult time keeping their feet and hands warm. Visibility is very poor. The winds are extreme. They can't talk to each other anymore. Lavoie and Brown are exchanging leads every half an hour and chopping steps as fast as they can. But at 19,000 feet, the body definitely slows down. You're starting to really feel the effects of altitude. And they're pushing as hard as they can. And right at the very top is a place that they called the Horseshoe Ridge. They could see that there were kind of two ridges that wrapped around. And at the very top of the horseshoe was what looked like the highest point. And as they started to crest on the right-hand part of this little horseshoe ridge, Belmore was in lead and came into the full force of the wind. They had been kind of in the lee of the wind, and as he crested up on this little plateau, he was hit by just violent gusts of winds that he could barely stand up against, let alone move forward. And all that he could tell was that the terrain had suddenly eased off. It was no longer steep. It was very, very gentle, and he couldn't move forward. And he went back down to Lavoie, and they chopped the place for the three of them to sit, and they were hoping to wait a second and see if the wind quit, and they all sat down and instantly stood up. They said, man, we're going to be way too cold, and they were very much in a survival situation at that point. They knew they had to get down in order to live. They could feel the warmth just being, you know, robbed of them with the violent winds. And so they headed down, and fortunately they had chopped all those steps because that's the only thing that they could find on the way down to give them any reference of where to go.
And their steps were going fast too.
Yeah, those steps were blowing in, but they could find them. They could find them in the, you know, soft snow in the steps, and they could feel them with their ice axe. And they got all the way back down to 19,000 and then had to dead reckon across the big flat section. And fortunately, they were right. They said they used the wind as their compass. Had the wind changed, it would have thrown them off. But luckily, the wind stayed steady, and they were able to dead reckon and hit the rocks on the top of the northeast ridge and finally get into the lee of the ridge and eventually down to high camp. Very close to the top and very close to not getting back down, you know. The weather was violent, and they had very little gear. It depended on getting back down.
And Belmore writes about it so, so eloquently and impassionedly in his book. I mean, The Conquest of Mount McKinley, if people haven't read it, is among the best adventure books about Alaska. And at that point, what Brian's describing just brought me back to Belmore's prose, and it was very, very moving.
Yeah, it is. His writing in general is very compelling, you know, and especially when you think of it, this appeared in these outdoors magazines, you know, where mostly you think of people boasting about the hunting, you know, and a little bit about the nature they went through, and then one of these gems shows up. Wow.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, he really paints a picture.
He totally, you know, transforms the genre.
That's right.
Yeah.
And, incredible perseverance.
Yeah, well, obviously. And so, Brian, this must be fun for you. You're going to get to put on a show, and you've gotten to be around all of these archives and these artifacts and everything. What can be done with all this stuff?
Well, hopefully we'll... we've got a lot of prints that we've had made of his photographs, and we're going to show those here at the Talkeetna Historical Society's museum, and we're going to show them at the hangar, at the Performing Arts Hangar, on July 21st, so people can see them, and hopefully there'll be some other places where they can be put up for the public to see. They really, they say it all. The pictures are really show the journey well.
Well, I'm thinking, there's some aspect here. There's an educational aspect someplace. I don't know exactly how it comes alive. I mean, Belmore did so much himself with his dioramas and all that. I mean, clearly he was into, let's communicate about this experience, these environments, these animals. I mean, that's one of the reasons we even have a Denali National Park when you boil it right down.
Well, this is, one of the things he did that was so marvelous was his documentation. Not only his journals, the photographs and the paintings, all those, add up to some really marvelous evidence of the path that he has chosen and left behind for the rest of us to follow. And, one of the things I just wanted to mention that it was thanks to an Alaska Humanities Forum grant that we were allowed to send Brian back to Dartmouth and look through those archives. And that's, that organization is really marvelous in helping Alaska, understand our own culture and keep tabs on things.
Yeah. Well, we're pretty much out of time here, guys. And I want to thank you all for being with us. Brian, you really get the last word if you got one.
Well, it was a different time 100 years ago. It's pretty interesting with no maps to speak of and no railroad, no roads, no communications, that these guys were just doing unbelievable things. They were really, just exploring every nook and cranny out there.
And it seems that we're, going back into those times, it really just increases our admiration to realize that the strength of those accomplishments.
Yeah, it really is. If you've ever, walked through an alder patch or tried to cross a raging river or, been in the mosquitoes and stuff, you really appreciate what these guys were doing.
Thanks so much for being with us. And I want to thank our whole crew, Josh Edge and Ish Strever and Dave Waldron.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Providence Imaging Center, helping your medical provider secure access to imaging results online so they can view your report quickly, whether you were seen in Eagle River, Anchorage, or Soldotna. Learn more at provimaging.com. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority supports a statewide system of care for people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism and substance abuse, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injury. You probably know a trust beneficiary, a family member, friend, coworker, neighbor, maybe you. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, here for all Alaskans. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.